The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 14th of March, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals, HZM ticker there, and Jeremy talks about their positive metallurgical results at their Vermelho project and other areas of the business. Also on the podcast, Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of Predator Oil and Gas, PRD is a ticker there, and Paul provides a progress update on their Trinidad operations and also covers their Moroccan and Irish projects. Plus, Ed Dawson, Managing Director of Prospects Oil and Gas, PXOG, discusses the new gas prospect they've added to their portfolio, gives a Baynet 1 production update, and talks about their recent fundraise. And as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a lot of other content. You'll see Malky's blog there. You'll see SP Angel's Morning View there. You'll see interviews in video, the Financial Press Review. Also, content on individual companies. So that's voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals. HZM is ticker there. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Justin, good morning. Good to speak to you.
Yeah, well, you've had some decent news out. Positive metallurgical test work for Vermelho, and we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, as always, Jeremy, if someone's tuning in for the first time or not familiar with the project there or the company, can you explain or summarise what Horizonte Minerals is all about, please?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a dual-listed company listed in London and on the main exchange in Canada. We're focused in Brazil, and we've got two Tier 1 nickel projects. The Araguaia ferronickel project is a discovery that we made, and we've taken all the way through to full feasibility that we completed in November last year. The feasibility study numbers on a capital cost of $440 million give you net cash flow over life of mine of $1.6 billion. And an NPV of over $400 million. So it's a very significant cash generative asset. And the key thing about Araguaia, it's high grade and will sit right at the bottom end of the cost curve. And then our second asset is the Vermelho Nickel Cobalt project that we acquired from Vale at the beginning of last year. Vale had spent over $200 million on this project, very high quality, high grade resource. And that is within trucking distance of Araguaia. So we now control one of the largest nickel resource bases globally, all within trucking distance of each other. So that's really our focus.
Yeah, so let's go into nickel. I mean, why nickel? What's it for? What's the market like? Because obviously it's highly, massively important, the commodity you choose. But take us through, you know, why you're into nickel and the market there around it, Jeremy, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. So nickel, the fundamentals behind nickel really are extremely compelling as we move into this year and next. I mean, obviously, main use for nickel is stainless steel. Stainless steel is used in everyday items from kettles through to pipework for high temperature corrosive environments. So it really is a key metal in everyday development. Mm-hmm. I think the exciting thing about nickel is if we look at inventories, we're now sitting at metal inventories, which are their lowest point for the last 6 years. Beginning of last year, we were at 400,000 tons of nickel on the LME and the Sheffy Exchange in China. Beginning of this year, that's down below 200,000 tons, so it's halved. Mm-hmm. We've got robust demand on that stainless side. That's running at around 5% year on year, and that's predicted out to the midterm. And what that means is you need over 100,000 to 150,000 tons of new nickel every year to maintain that balance. So running that out to sort of 2025, that's 22 new Araguaias to come online. So nickel market robust, driven by stainless steel. And on top of that, you've had the electric vehicle sort of revolution, which really has come extremely rapidly into the marketplace. And if we were back sort of 4 or 5 years ago, it was probably, well, it may affect us at some point soon. now we're saying we're all going to be driving electric vehicles in the sort of the mid to short term. And the key penetration point for electric vehicles is around 2025 to 2030. And we could be up to anywhere between 20 to 40 million electric vehicles globally. And nickel is a key component in the electric vehicle battery. And what that means is there needs to be a further million tons of new nickel coming online to support that battery arena. So where's that going to come from? And if you look at nickel projects globally, a big nickel project will take between 8 to 10 years to come online. And because there's been so little underdevelopment or underfunding or in the nickel space over the last 5 to 10 years, there really are very few big new nickel projects that can come online in the short term. And that's why we're extremely well placed with Araguaia followed by Vermelho.
Okay. And well, let's dig into Vermelho here. You've had some positive metallurgical test work results back from there. So take us through what this means and why it's significant.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously a lot of work has been done on Vermelho by Vale, very high quality work. But we really wanted to see if we could process the mineral resource there using the ferronickel route that we're effectively developing at Araguaia. So we tested a number of samples, blended compositions, and we were able to produce high-grade ferronickel, grading around 30% nickel, commercial grade for the stainless steel manufacturers, low deleterious elements. And really, it's a big de-risking step for the project. It means that it's amenable to use that tried and tested RKEF rotary kiln electric furnace process that we're developing for Araguaia. So a big step forwards on that. And in parallel, we also have test work underway, which is nearing completion, to produce high-grade nickel and cobalt sulfate, which can be used in the EV battery market.
Yeah. And what's the next sort of step here at Vermelho?
So on completion of that test work, we've got a pre-feasibility underway. So the test work from this will flow into that study. And the aim is that we'll have the pre-feasibility study complete mid-year, and that will allow you to put some economics around the project. And we're fairly confident that this will return similar, if not higher, economics to Araguaia. So it means that you're going to have probably somewhere around $800 to $900 million of NPV in the company, which is a big step forwards. And then obviously that allows us to take that out to the marketplace, and the aim is that we'll be looking to secure a partner to advance Vermelho.
Okay. And mentioning Araguaia, what's happening there?
Yeah, so Araguaia, we're very busy on that front as well. Obviously, as I said earlier, we released the feasibility late last year. Just to recap, in January we got our construction license, which is another big de-risking step, and we're currently working through the project financing stage. We're getting very positive responses. We're looking at a number of financing routes. Obviously, the traditional project finance underwritten by debt, commercial debt. And we've got a number of the large commercial banks interested in the project. We're also looking at strategic funding options. And we're also looking at other non-dilutive funding options on that. We've got a number of parties in the data room under NDA. And really driven by the positive fundamentals around the nickel market, we're getting a lot of interest on that. So we should be able to provide some positive updates to the market over the coming months.
Yeah. And when I often hear people saying, you know, you bought these projects off, you know, big operators. Why did the big operators get rid of them?
You see this time and time again. I mean, at the point that we acquired these projects, both the acquiring the northern part of the Araguaia district from Glencore, which we acquired around 5 years ago, that was when nickel price collapsed and hit 15-year lows. So it really was right at the bottom of the market. Mm. And effectively, everyone was stepping out of nickel. And the same again with the acquisition from Vale of Vermelho. Again, it was a bottom of the market transaction. And it's a typical cyclical model that you see in the juniors. You develop, acquire these assets right at the bottom end of the price range. You add the value, you take them through feasibility, through construction, and you bring them online in the sort of the uprising nickel market. And we've seen it in the copper space. Something like Lumina Copper would be a very good example in South America, where they acquired 7 or 8 very large copper porphyry projects, many of them from the major mining companies at the bottom of the copper cycle. They added value to each project, and the average sale price for each project when the copper price was high was over $500 million. And you see this time and time again, juniors divesting at, or majors divesting at the bottom end of the price cycle, and then potentially buying back in as pricing returned. It's a classic cyclical situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I did talk to you just before we came on. I said the market's very hard at the moment. You know, like I say, for example, you are unlocking value here, developing the projects, and yet if you look at your share price, it's now back to where it was in 2016. It's, you know, it was at to 2 pence back then. You've got the 5 pence, come back down. It's maybe very frustrating to do that for you. And I don't know, last week there was an issue with a institutional investor. I mean, take us through that, because that set back a lot of companies. You know, I was watching the market and lots of companies were selling off and we didn't understand why, and then it was sort of revealed why. But take us through what happened there, if you could, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think it's obviously extremely frustrating for us as a management team. Q4 last year, the whole market was sold down, and the AIM Junior Mining Index was sold down very hard. And you saw companies losing 50, 60, 70% of their value in the last quarter last year. And we fell into that category. It's not a Horizonte specific issue. This is a market driven issue. And you've obviously got some fairly significant macro challenges at the moment. In the commodities space, it's obviously the US-China trade posturing is the overhang on the commodity space. And then obviously closer to home here for the generalist money, we've got the ongoing Brexit situation. So that is challenging. If you look at our particular share price over the last month, yes, we had one of our major institutions, City Financial, effectively announced voluntary liquidation on Wednesday, 10 days ago. And on the Friday, the position they held in Horizonte, which was 7%, which was just over 100 million shares, was sold into the market. So that's a fairly large position to be absorbed over a 24-hour period. So that really obviously set the price back. And I think what we're seeing at the moment, that the sort of volumes we're seeing, is really that position being realigned across a number of positions in the market. So, yes, frustrating. Having said that, it's a great entry point for people. I mean, I've been and seen all of our institutional shareholders in the last week, the likes of JP Morgan, etc. And they're all very positive on the story and supportive. So it's one of those situations where, yes, it's frustrating. We've got a good register with Teck, Glencore, obviously JP Morgan, Lombard Odier. It is a good register. We're well funded. We've got over 6.5 million in the company today, so we won't be doing any short-term fundraisers at these levels. And as I said earlier, we're getting very positive developments around the financing for Araguaia. So it's one of these things. We are unlocking significant value, and it is a great value play. If you go back to, I've talked about it a number of times, the Kaneko Resources transaction, where Vale acquired the Onça Puma project, which is about 120 kilometers north of us in Brazil, at essentially construction stage. They paid $850 million for it in 2005. Today, Horizonte has effectively got the equivalent of 3 Onça Pumas in the portfolio between the combined resource base. So it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and do you think at the moment, you know, this sort of, you know, worry, this, and it is uncertainty, like you say, it's uncertainty of Brexit, it's uncertainty with China and America. Do you think it'll play out, you know, before the end of this year, or do you think it'll drag on for longer than that?
I can't really obviously give you a sort of a...
I know.
I think things will resolve themselves in the shorter term. What I do know is if we fundamentally focus on nickel, robust demand, inventory drawdown, and virtually no new projects that can come online in the next 24, 36 months, that is an extremely interesting position. And whenever you see that, these very tight inventory positions with demand, it always leads to increasing in price. And if you look at analyst midterm short-term forecast, it's around 16,500. We use 14,000 long-term in our project financials for Araguaia. I think as we move through this year, you're going to see some extremely positive developments around the company, and I think Araguaia really will start to drive the value that we've talked about for the last 12 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, in summary, Jeremy, if someone's not following the story, and like you say, right now with this uncertainty, that's where you, as a contrarian, that's where all the successful investors invest. When there's uncertainty in the market, that's the cheapest price you'll get pretty much in any stock. So if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing there, but are not following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Absolutely. Number one, nickel market fundamentals are compelling, driven by robust demand for stainless steel and massive future growth in the electric vehicle market, all requiring new nickel to come online. Number two, we've got two tier one assets, the largest, highest grade resource base in a non-producing company. And number three, Araguaia, construction ready, moving through the project finance stage. And you're going to see some major milestones over the next 12 to 24 months on that project. So it's a very exciting time for the business.
Marvellous stuff, Jeremy. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Many thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of Predator Oil & Gas, PRD is the ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. It's a very windy day here. I'm not sure how it is with you, but
it's very similar here. I think it's quite similar to the political environment. Actually, it's all over the place. So let's. So Paul, you released some news yesterday. Progress in Trinidad. Now that's not your only interest or prospect or asset. So before we go into that news, just give us a brief summary as to what Predator Oil & Gas is all about, please, Paul.
Yeah, we have three key areas, core areas. One is near-term production in Trinidad. The second area is trying to upscale that production through the relationship we've now established with Heritage. Third area is Morocco and near-term drilling activity. And then the fourth area is Ireland with the potential for M&A transactions, which we recognise now being quite attractive in the short term.
Yeah, okay. Well, the update is concerning, obviously, a near-term cash generation, revenue generation there, but via carbon dioxide enhanced oil recovery. How's progress? What's happening, Paul?
Yeah, I think, I need to give just a slight overview of the background on Heritage. Heritage was formed out of the old Petrochin, and it only really came into existence in the fourth quarter of last year. So it's a new state entity. Now, what's really interesting is that when we presented this to the CEO of Heritage at the end of January, we actually got the consent within 1 month from the presentation of our CO2 EOR project. Now, that's simply unheard of in Trinidad in terms of the old practices of Petrochin and the time it took. So this is absolutely refreshing from the point of view of getting consent for this project in such a rapid time. Mm-hmm. And I think I need to sort of explain why perhaps that came about. Is firstly, you have a new entity, a refreshingly different attitude to doing business. Secondly, Heritage recognizes, as does the government of Trinidad, the strategic importance of CO2 EOR, and we are the pathfinder for this process. I'd also make one other point in the sense that Heritage, because they inherited the Petrochin assets, are the largest producer of oil onshore Trinidad and have the largest amount of reserves in the mature producing fields. So for us, it's a huge business opportunity to establish this conduit to Heritage, and it allows us, because we have security over the CO2, exclusively over the CO2 supply, if we have a successful pilot with Heritage and on this project, it opens the door for all kinds of projects with Heritage to increase our production profile. So that's why this announcement was so important. I actually believe the market hasn't actually factored that into anything at present. I think they don't understand why this was such a groundbreaking announcement. It's a simple consent.
It's almost as it's saying this is, what you've got here is base case, and like I said, this is a trial for future potential there, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I don't think the market perhaps understands that. But, you know, the dash for production is important. But getting that production under circumstances where you can upscale it in a success case is also very, very important for the company's fortunes going forward, not just in the short term. Mm-hmm. And I also would stress that, you know, we have not been delayed in our operational plan waiting on consents. I mean, maybe there's a perception that we've just sat there arms akimbo waiting for something to happen, but anything's been advanced along the budget schedule we set out and gave market guidance on, and nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. What has changed is that we now have third-party validation of our commercial and technical model for CO2 EOR from Heritage, the largest owner of producing reserves onshore Trinidad. So I think that's an important step forward.
And as far as this, you know, the start of now and the sort of chronologically time frames going forward, what's happening then in his Trinity field, and what are the dates we're looking at?
We have absolutely given guidance to the market that we are striving for first production from CO2 EOR in the first half of 2019. We've said that, and nothing's changed. And nothing has changed in terms of what we believe from pre-planning is the forecast for what we could achieve out of this project initially, which is 300 barrels a day. And that's the target. That's what we're trying to do. Naturally, we hope to increase that target over time, but nobody can make that prediction until we have the data from the CO2 EOR pilot. Once we have that data, we can revise forecasts for the whole of the AT4 block. We're only actually dealing at present with just two production wells in the AT4 block in order to achieve that 300 barrels a day. But with the results of the CO2 EOR pilot, we can then add additional wells to that portfolio of producing wells. So I think the focus is on production, yes, but the focus is also on getting the results of the pilot from a technical point of view to see what the opportunity is to upscale production in the Innis Trinity field. And everybody is aligned in doing that. We now have Heritage aligned with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're hoping the objective is to start off with 300 barrels of oil per day, and the cost of production there is low, isn't it?
The cost of production includes the CO2 costs, you know, the operational costs. But the cost, or the net back for us, is lower. It's higher, I should say, because the taxes are lower. We won't be paying the 50% profit tax because there's a historical tax losses that are offset against that. So that makes a big difference to net back per barrel if you're not paying those that 50% profit tax. So it's not related necessarily to all the operating costs. The operating costs are what they are with CO2 EOR, but it's the fact that, you know, you can utilize tax losses because you're producing enough income to use up those tax losses.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying total, you're looking at around about total sort of cost here at $600,000, and of course you're funded for that.
Yeah, we've our range over the last 12 months has been between $500,000 and $800,000, and right now we're working on between $500,000 and $600,000 in capital costs for the cost of the project. Obviously, with fluctuating exchange rates every month, every day, that's why we have to give this range, because you know, we raise our money in sterling. We've hedged our money, as we discussed before, by converting to US dollars a while back at a very good rate. So we always have to have that little bit of flexibility on the actual cost, depending on if we need some additional dollars to meet the $500,000 to $600,000 range, depending on exchange rates, etc., and also the local exchange rate to Trinidadian dollars. So managing the exchange rate is quite a crucial part of the process to ensure that, you know, we're well prepared for any fluctuations that might result as a result of Brexit.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite volatile at the moment, the pound. So news is almost imminent there. There's lots of going on, so not far off from something material happening there. What about your other interests then, Paul?
Well, turning to Morocco, everything's advancing towards signing the Guernsey Petroleum Agreement with ONI imminently. I'm not going to give you a date because we haven't released a firm date into the market, but it is imminent, very imminent. So the next step after that will be within a few days of that happening, we will issue the CPR, the Competent Persons Report for Guernsey, and then very shortly after that, we'll give an update on drilling preparations and the commencement of the planning for drilling and also the environmental impact study assessment that we have to do for drilling. So that's the three very, very, very near-term things that will be in the pipeline in terms of news flow on Morocco. Mm-hmm. If there are concerns as to how we're going to finance drilling, I just would emphasize that we have many ways of financing drilling activity in our industry, including the conventional farm out route. And in this instance, because the drilling costs are so low and the potential prize is so high and the ability to monetize is so relatively easy given proximity to gas pipelines with spare capacity, we will be looking at a larger multi-well drilling program from a potential farm-in. So we are pretty confident that this project is sufficiently attractive to attract the right kind of company in the right kind of commercial environment for us in the short to very, very short to early medium term. And by that, I mean 2019, obviously.
Yeah.
And the other thing you might have seen recently announced is Qatar Petroleum has farmed into the Tafaya offshore blocks that Eni hold. And of course, you know, that just reflects the fact that, you know, Morocco's back on the radar for exploration again in a big way. And I think people should start waking up to the fact that Moroccan activity now is ramping up for not just us, but for a number of companies. And that'll create a great background to news flow too, which is positive for company and positive for our shareholders.
Yeah. Okay. And Ireland?
In Ireland, we are really focused on two parts of the business in Ireland. As you know, Ireland is a longer-term process in terms of regulatory approvals, etc. So we believe that our portfolio assets are very well suited to an M&A opportunity to utilize the value of that portfolio next to infrastructure for a near-term benefit to our shareholders. But we have to weigh that up against the longer-term benefit of developing the portfolio of the assets, investing heavily through farm-out and through through farm-out, effectively, in terms of a drilling program, and whether that will achieve the same value for us as shareholders in the company, all of us as shareholders in the company, versus an opportunity for a nearer-term M&A transaction, given the substance of our assets. And everything, of course, is subject to regulatory approval. But one option, you know, with M&A is allows you to get a nearer-term value for your assets, whereas the development drilling is, exploration drilling is going to be a bit more drawn out with a farm and E. And we have to balance that against the rest of the portfolio. For us, the next 12 months wants to be a period of absolute activity on all fronts. And therefore, Ireland and the M&A opportunities that may exist there are obviously, you know, critical to us for shorter term value rather than look to the longer term through a farm out drilling program. But both options are being looked at aggressively and pursued aggressively.
Yeah, absolutely. So lots going on. Are you, you must be quite excited, quite bullish then, Paul?
Yeah, I am bullish because, you know, I feel that we didn't have enough activity on the portfolio until we went down the Morocco route. Now, Morocco balances our activity, gives us some more exciting news flow over the next, you know, 6-9 months to underpin, you know, the production that we're targeting in Trinidad. So it just gives a better balance to our portfolio. It means people can look at drilling activity in the short term and get a bit more excited rather than continually focusing on production, which is very, very important for the cash flow of the company. But Morocco just gives us, you know, an exciting near-term opportunity, a much, much more opportunity for increased news flow. And Ireland, you know, the route we're looking at in Ireland allows for the fact that, you know, processors in Ireland, as we all know, and nobody should be under any illusion, they take time. And, you know, we as a company are not prepared to sit around spending money, wasting time. So Ireland has to figure in a near term, a potential for a near term M&A transaction. I think that's in the best interest of shareholders. They don't want us wasting running costs, pursuing projects indefinitely to the farm out stage and then the development exploration drilling stage if there's an opportunity to get real value for those projects in the shorter term for our shareholders, particularly in the current environment that we sit in, where there's so much uncertainty as to what may happen over Brexit and the financial markets. We have to look at short, medium term, early medium term value. We can't and how we can extrapolate that in these circumstances that we now live in.
Marvellous. Well, Paul, to remind people, if they're not following you right now, but they like the progress of what you're doing, give them 3 points in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, firstly, near-term production and cash flow opportunity in Trinidad. Secondly, the potential to upscale in the shorter medium term the production growth in Trinidad through the new relationship or the developing relationship with Heritage. And thirdly, a jaw-dropping opportunity for gas in Morocco related to near-term drilling.
Marvellous stuff, Paul. Good to chat to you. And like you say, lots going on at the moment, and no doubt news will be coming out very soon. So look forward to chatting to you
it
again.
Will
not,
be.
Yeah, well, we'll chat again in not too distant future then.
I'm off to my board meeting now for a meaningful vote. So at least our board's united on one objective, which is to create value for our shareholders. So that will be a positive, meaningful vote.
Marvellous, Paul. Speak soon.
Okay, good to talk to you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ed Dawson, Managing Director of Prospects Oil and Gas, PXOG is the ticker there. Ed, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, you've got several bits of news out and got some private investor questions that are submitted to you. You've found in your mailbag, as it were. So we'll get to those in a bit. Before we do, as always, Ed, if someone's listening who's not familiar with Prospect Oil and Gas, could you just summarise what the company's all about, please?
Yeah, Prospect Oil and Gas is an AIM-listed investment vehicle that invests in the oil and gas sector. We're an experienced management team that run a number of companies and return multiples of money to shareholders. In the last 18 months, we've participated in two wells, which have both been successful. And we now have a portfolio in Romania, half a license there, a sixth of a license in Italy, and a potentially huge project in Spain that we presently own 15% of. In Italy, we've recently had our first maiden reserves, and we are looking to get the Selva discovery on production in 2020, which will generate a huge step up in cash flow for us. And in Spain, we're moving an exploration program forward to chase 800 BCF prospective resources.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, let's go move to Romania at the moment, and you've added a new gas prospect to the portfolio. You've enlarged the area there, and also you've been talking about production in the recent release. So first and foremost, let's go through why you've enlarged this concession, why you've gone for a bigger acreage here, Ed.
Yeah. We entered into Romania to drill a number of what we saw were shallow, low-risk opportunities. What we've done is extend the block to the west, at the very northerly end of it, near our existing production at Bayonet. We had the opportunity to extend the license to capture this prospect called Bayonet West that we've known about for a while. It's on clearly visible on seismic. It's similar characteristics and similar AVO responses. It's the same depth as Bayonet and sits in a similar position close to a fault. So we believe that it's a, for an exploration sense, is very, very low risk. and listeners will either remember or make them aware of now, we have a very good partner in Romania who is able to, you know, move these things on. We put on the Bernit well from the exploration well onto production in 11 months. So for us, we think there's a very good chance that Bernit West will be a success, and that will lead to additional production for us in Romania. Mm-hmm. It's another cash flow stream for the company.
Yeah, cool. And you talk about production there. First of all, how much does this extra acreage cost you then?
What we've done is we've offered to pay from production half of Raffles' costs with the maturing the prospect up. So we're paying half for 250,000, 125,000.
Okay.
We haven't had to give any increased work commitments to the national agency or anything like that, because of they've basically enlarged the existing area, supposed to give us a new area.
I see. Yeah. Okay. All right. So you mentioned production at Bernit 1. So what's production like there at the moment, and what does it mean to people who can't work in cubic meters a day and all that stuff? What does that mean in monetary terms?
Well, in monetary terms, we will be netting somewhere between 40 and 60,000 euros a month. We've guided production for the whole of 2018, an average of 15,000 cubic meters a day. Mm-hmm. If guys want to work that into cubic feet, they need to times it by basically 34 cubic feet per cubic meter.
Yeah.
So it's good, you know, the reservoir is performing in line with the operator's expectations. We believe that Bernit West will pay back somewhere between 12 and 18 months. Obviously, it slightly depends on production rates at the individual well, and it obviously depends on gas prices, so to say, in a year's time. So that's why we think it's a well worthwhile investment. What it does is pay back in the industry terms relatively quickly, and obviously cash flow from it for a good number of years.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the fundraise. You raised 800,000 gross there, and I know apparently some people have been asking you, why did you do a fundraise when the share price was quite low as it is, and why have you used equity?
Okay. Well, I've been on the podcast on a number of occasions, and we've talked about funding of exploration companies. Yeah. Obviously, we are fortunate with Italy potentially. Well, will be coming on stream in 2020, and that's a big cash flow. We can see 1.5 million, 2 million euros of revenue to us. On startup there. Now, that enables us to look at alternative fundings to equity, and for certainly the industry often uses for appraisal and development work non-equity methods. However, whilst we believe this is very low risk, it is an exploration well, we felt equity was the appropriate way to fund it. Mm-hmm. Why now? Obviously, with the acreage being open, there was a possibility that other people could have taken it, and therefore we wanted to move to take the acreage and actually get on and drill it. As I've explained, it makes good business sense to move this forward and get it on production, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. And the question is, have the directors participated in the fundraise?
They haven't. Now, people obviously would be good if they could. People would see that as a signal. However, I don't want to hide behind it, but I don't think often, or certainly parts of the investment community understand how difficult it is for management to participate since the MAR regulations came in 2016. We are virtually constantly in a closed period. And secondly, actually, underlying investors do not know the personal circumstances of the directors. So actually, it's arguably, you know, quite meaningless. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't read too much into it. You know, I'm not going to talk about personal circumstances of my management team or directors. However, I would remind people that the non-execs have continued to invest money into the company over the last 6 months. In fact, I think they've probably invested three times more than they've taken out on their what they would say is meager stipends. So the management and directors are firmly committed to the business. I ask, you know, if people want to look at that, it's there in writing. They have to look a bit further than the last week, but certainly the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, and one final thing that Ed had to do, as always, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I'm going to give you three reasons which may you know, appeal to many people, or certainly, hopefully, lots of diverse groups of investors. Clearly, the well is going to generate lots of news flow. As I say, in a success case, we've demonstrated that in the past you can get wells on within a year. So that the whole process is going to generate news flow, which I think the market likes. We clearly have a diversified portfolio with assets in Romania, Italy, and Spain. And I would point to, you know, we have a huge discount to the risk fair value. You know, even the latest CPR on one Italian asset put the value of that asset at 4.7 million euros. We then look at Spain with, you know, huge potential there, and Romania generating, you know, good but steady cash. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Marvellous stuff. Ed, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Just thank you for having me. I don't know whether I'm going to see you there, but certainly I would invite investors to come and see myself and the team at the UK Investor Show at the end of March. We're on stand 36.
Marvellous, stand 36. You see Ed there in all his finery. And marvellous stuff, Ed, and I may see you there. Who knows? Thanks very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Bidstack Group, BIDS. I don't know if you heard James and Fran on the podcast yesterday, CEO and CTO, Chief Technical Officer, talking about the potential of Bidstack. Now, some people say it's just, you know, an in-game advertising company. It's not. You know, it's much more than that. I'm starting to get the story. I liked it anyway because gaming is massive. But these guys are trailblazing. They are basically cutting out a niche here, carving out a furrow there in this native in-game advertising space. And they're connecting with programmatic supply side and demand side platforms. And they're the first people to be doing this. And so, as we know, the sort of, you know, advertising in games, gaming is a massive industry, bigger than movies and music put together, but it's underserved by advertising. And this is one of the areas that has massive potential. And these guys, a small little company, right, has got exclusive access, and they've got lots of major contracts, and it'll get bigger and better, I think. But they're in a very exciting space. Like I say, they, from a regulatory point of view, they are ticking the boxes. From a technical point of view, they're ticking the boxes. So I really like what they're doing. It's hard to say right now, but I think Bidstack, if they do what they say they're hopefully going to do, like James said in the podcast, they could be one of the best, you know, performers over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Absolutely. Okay, at four. Listen, I own stock in the company, by the way, so I'm biased, of course. I may be completely wrong. Okay, at four, Horizonte Minerals, HZM. At three, Bacanora Lithium, BCN. At two, Net Scientific. And that's had a big rise of late. I don't know what it was, some restructuring of debt or something. But NSCI, or some kind of funding update. But the number one most followed company on Vox Markets is Proactis Holdings, PHD. A lot of people are looking at that on Twitter and following it and buying it. And they've had a profit warning, of course, from trying to buy the rebound, I think. Okay. At 5 on the most liked RNSs, it's Premier African Minerals. Update on RHA. At 4, Angus Energy. SPA signed regarding additional interest in Lidzi. At 3, Jangada Mines. Updated corporate video. At 2, Vesarian. Letter of intent with Tongshu Optoelectronic. Hopefully we'll get Neil on the podcast very soon. And at number 1, Jeremy's on the podcast today. Horizonte Minerals. Positive metallurgical test work for Vermelio. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.